Hi, everyone. My name is Maya, and welcome to Psych Mike, the podcast that explores the lives and career paths of industry leaders who use psychology to make an impact in the world. This week is part two of my interview with Dr. Barry Farber and Daisy Ort about becoming a competitive applicant to doctoral programs in clinical psychology. If you haven't listened to part one yet, which is the episode from last week, then I encourage you to do that before listening to this one. If you're new to Psych Mike, we don't only cover careers in clinical areas, so if you're wanting to explore other options, then those definitely exist on this podcast. You can go to psychmike.com and search for those episodes by your interest and by category, or you can just scroll through whatever podcast platform you use to listen. Okay, so to refresh your memory, part one last week focused mainly on the preparing side of things. So topics that relate to anything about gaining the necessary experience before it actually comes time to apply to graduate school. In part two, today's interview, we will focus mainly on applying itself. So all of the things that go into compiling your actual application and really nailing it. So, for example, compiling your list of schools, assessing program fit, personal statements, letters of recommendation, GRE scores, CVs, finding faculty mentors, and so much more. So in today's episode, you can assume that everything we're talking about is actually relating to PhD admissions, unless we specifically mention PsyDs. Now, in last week's episode, we spend the first chunk of it talking about different kinds of programs in which you can get licensed to be a clinician. So not just clinical or counseling PhD programs, but also PsyD programs, MSW programs, MFT programs, other master's programs. So if you're wanting to explore that more, then go to part one. But today we'll be focusing mainly on doctoral programs, specifically PhD programs. And again, to refresh your memory, I collected questions from the audience, from you guys, through my newsletter, through Instagram, and just through asking around. So all of these questions are really based on things that I've heard from the audience, from you guys, about what you want to know about this process. So to be able to answer your burning questions about applying to grad school, I interviewed two people whom I trust very much to give you top-notch information about the admissions process. So first, we have Daisy Ort, whom some of you may remember if you came to Psych Mike's grad school panel in November 2021. Daisy is a fourth-year PhD candidate in clinical psychology at Teachers College, Columbia University. Besides obviously having gone through the grad school process herself, Daisy has helped countless students through every stage of the grad school application process to clinical programs. So she really understands this process inside out. And if by the end of this you want more advice from Daisy and other students in clinical areas, then I've linked the recording from our grad school panel in November in the show notes. Along with her, we have her doctoral advisor, Dr. Barry Farber. And Dr. Farber has been on doctoral admissions committees for over 40 years. So that means that he reviews hundreds of applications every single year, and he really understands what makes for a successful application. Barry was also the director of clinical training at Teachers College, Columbia University for 25 years. So if you haven't listened to last week's episode yet, you may be listening today and find yourself having more questions about certain topics. So for example, I will mention clinical and research experiences today, but we're not talking about those in depth in today's episode. So if it's not about the actual application itself, then that's probably in last week's episode. However, if there's something that we didn't talk about in either last week's episode or this week's episode that you still have questions about, which I'm sure you will because there's no way we can cover all the information about applying to grad school in 2 1-hour episodes, please do reach out to me at psychmikepodcast@gmail.com or on psychmike.com at the bottom of the homepage. You'll see an option to submit a form or through Instagram DMs at the handle psych_mike. And send me your questions, and I'll see how I can get those answered by Daisy, by Dr. Farber, or other extremely knowledgeable people, either in the future, in future episodes, in future blog posts, newsletters, or Instagram posts. Okay, so here are some questions that you can expect to get some answers to today. How do I compile a list of graduate schools that I want to apply to? What factors should I consider as I'm putting together this list? How picky can I be about which PhD programs I apply to and which ones I attend? How do I write an outstanding personal statement? Are there any topics that I should avoid talking about on my personal statement? What should my relationship between my CV and my personal statement be? To what extent should I know the faculty advisor whose lab I'm applying to in graduate school? Should I introduce myself beforehand? How do I get noticed by faculty in this massive sea of applications? How do I know if I have a strong enough letter writer? What do I do if I feel like I don't have a strong enough letter of recommendation? Do my GRE scores matter? Where should I go to prep for the GRE? How do I consider finances? How do I gauge fit with faculty members? These are all topics that are sometimes hard to find straight answers to online, and so I'm really glad that we can start this conversation together here. But again, it deserves more than a couple of hours, so if you're left with more questions, please do reach out, like I said earlier, and do check out the show notes if you're curious about other topics that we discussed today and their timestamps. All right, so let's start learning about how to put together a competitive application to doctoral programs in clinical psychology. I will also say that if you do know a friend who is currently in this process, is considering this process, please do send this episode to them if you think it'll be helpful. All right, let's get into it. First thing is you got to compile your list of schools. Daisy, I feel like you have a little bit of a formula here of the things you want to consider, you know, the major factors to consider when you're putting a list of school together. What are those factors?
Not in order of priority, but what people could think about when they're making the list. And I feel like I keep mentioning this like a broken record, but where are you willing to live? What can you afford? What program is a good fit for your research or your clinical interests or both? Is the program good quality? Which I think a big way to gauge that is looking at match rates. I don't know if there's another or better way. You have a program that has a 50% match rate. It's just something to worry about. And of course, APA accredited. And so when I was compiling my list, I knew that every school had to fall into like meeting those criteria, where I was willing to live, what I was willing to pay, et cetera. And then when it came to faculty, advisor, areas of interest, it didn't have to be the same exact benefit across all schools. So I have a strong interest in working with justice involved individuals or forensic settings. And some schools really focused on that and had a faculty that were very experienced in those areas. And then let's say psychotherapy research is something that also was extremely interesting to me. And so it doesn't have to be like one thing interests you. It's the only thing. I mean, there's like a lot of things that could interest people. I've also applied to schools that focus on underserved and marginalized individuals, because that's what interested me about justice involved work. And so really I had to, like, for me, I looked at my list and again, it had to be affordable, had to be a good program. It had to be somewhere I was willing to live. And it had to be a place that I thought I would really be interested in going based on the faculty, or the focus of the program.
Right.
It didn't have to be the same thing in every school.
Yeah.
In fact, very different things that made me drawn to different programs.
Yeah. So I know when you're looking at programs that they fall on a spectrum of emphasizing research versus clinical work. Would you say TC is pretty balanced?
Okay, I'll say that. Actually true. But that's a yes, but I think on the whole, and actually I think Daisy could answer this better than me having gone through the program, but I think from faculty's point of view, we try and we believe in a balance between clinical and research experiences and curriculum. That said, depending on whom you're working with, the faculty with whom you're working with, you may be spending much of your time doing that person's research rather than having the time to pursue clinical experiences more than what's required. So the point is that the program may have a philosophy, but you may have to adjust thinking about that philosophy based on your own, on what your mentor needs from you, wants from you.
Okay. Now let's talk about prestige and how, like, does that matter? Does that matter if you're getting a PhD?
Daisy was a terrific candidate. So I think she could legitimately say, this is where I can live, where I want to live, whom I want to work with. I think there's a lot of people who probably can get into PhD programs who aren't quite the ideal candidate who are going to get into, you know, 5 or 6 programs a year. And this is sort of a common refrain of mine and a point of contention. I actually don't think that people who really, really want to do this work should have restrictions on where they're going to live. I think it's a little bit like medical school. If you have a calling to be a physician, you're actually going to be placed in a medical school and you're just going to take it because it's so important for you to be a physician. I think for the most part, the same thing should be true. If you want to be a PhD therapist, don't say you can only do it in Boston or New York or Washington or San Francisco. If it's that important to you, allow yourself to be in the middle of the country. Okay, you don't want to be there for 5 years or 6 years. I get it. But if this is what you want to do in your career, suck it up and do it.
Oh, geez. You prepared me for this, Daisy.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I want to clarify that when I say make a list of places you're willing to live, do not, if you want to do this more than you want to be in New York City, only apply to New York City programs that are fully funded. I applied to Nebraska Lincoln as part of my top choices because I was interested in program over where I live. So I think that when I say geography, I mean, where are you willing to go? Because if you get into someplace really far and then you're like, I'm not going, then why did you burn that bridge? You're never going to get into that program again. But yeah, like this is not a kind of a field where you get to be super picky when it comes to, and when it comes to choosing a program, if you really, really want to do this. And that's why a lot of people apply twice. And the first year they apply to kind of all their dream programs. And then the second year they get more. And Dr. Barber, we just had a student who did that, right? They applied to their top choices last year. They actually didn't get interviews. It wasn't the programs weren't a good fit. And then a year later, they improved some part to their application and they applied to a totally different spread of programs and got many, many interviews. And so that's also one way to go about this.
So what happens if you, okay, I know you have strong beliefs about this, Dr. Farber. So if you, let's say you apply to programs, you get in to one or two, or let's just say one, but you're like, I really don't want to go to Ohio.
Go. Because there's so little guarantees. In fact, there's no guarantee you're going to get it. If you only got into one program this year, what makes you think you're going to have more choices next year? It's not fair. You can be a terrific candidate, but even the most terrific candidates are only getting into a small percentage of the program. So you got into one program last year. There's a whole different pool next year. The pool may be more competitive than the year you applied. You've got a shot to fulfill your dream. Take it.
But aren't there so many, like I'm thinking about, for example, what if you have a partner, you have children that you, it's not easy to just pick up and go, you know what, it is my dream, let's say, but I can't necessarily pick up and bring my children to the middle of the country. I can't relocate my partner's job. Should you just keep applying to those programs that you only in geographical locations that you know you can be?
That's fair. If your partner can't pick up, then you don't apply to those programs to begin with. But I'm saying if you have freedom, if you're a single person and you have freedom and the only restriction is I don't feel like being there, I don't think that's a good excuse.
Okay.
Because I think you have to look in your soul and say, this is my calling. Then you don't set up a different standard for I don't feel like being in this place to pursue your dream. You pursue your dream if you have the opportunity.
I think this kind of conversation is going to prompt some reflections in people about like, how much do I really want this? Like, am I really in this? Like, I'll go no matter where.
I keep going back to this. Like, this is all important for people to figure out if they want to do this, because it's like, we can have a podcast on like how to get dates from dating apps. And we can talk about how to make your profile. I might have more experience doing this than Dr. Barber, but how to make your profile super competitive and how to get those right swipes and how to get out on the first date. But then if you're on your fourth date and you like made the whole situation work that like this person really likes you, And then you're like, oh, but I don't like this person. It's like all of that work and setting up your profile and getting all the tricks to get the person to keep wanting to date you doesn't help if you didn't want to be with them. And so I just think that it's a pretty bad analogy. People tell me they understand me until I give it.
I get you.
But it's really thinking, because I could tell you, like, I don't have one day that I regret this, and I love it so much. And I feel so fortunate that this is what I'm getting to do. But trust me, if I didn't want to do it for all the reasons I want to do it, I would be pretty miserable. You don't make money for many, many years. You have a very intense, busy schedule. You're getting to do rewarding work that's also extremely emotionally taxing as you develop muscles on how to hear things that are really hard to hear. Like, it's a really, really big commitment. This is not like get your foot in the door and then whatever. It's like being in the middle of the country where you don't want to be is probably going to be the least of the challenges of those 5 or 6 years that have a lot of navigating and effort and work. And so really great to prompt introspection and think, do you really want to do this? And how badly do you want to do it? Because there's a million other opportunities. Mm-hmm.
You're going to meet some great people no matter where you are.
Mm. We've kind of strayed a little from the application piece, but let me see where I wanted to go with this. Another question I got is, when do faculty know that they're going to be able to accept students for that cycle? And should you delay applying if your top few choices are not admitting students for the upcoming cycle?
Most of the websites of programs will let you know in September which faculty members are taking for that cycle. If not, you can probably call the secretary of the program and find out. You might even email the particular faculty member you're interested in. I get those emails a lot. I'm sure most faculty members do.
Yeah.
Should you delay? Well, I can't imagine a year in which at least some potential mentors aren't taking students. If that's the case, you're restricting yourself far too much.
Is it helpful to email potential advisors to introduce yourself? And I know you said you get a lot of emails. I am sure you don't respond to every single one. You probably don't respond to most of them.
I actually pride myself. I respond to every email I get.
Wow.
I have an anecdote to support that. Not that you need my, I went out with an intern at Bellevue where I'm currently an extern. And I mentioned Dr. Farber as my advisor, and he said, oh my God, he does self-disclosure work. And he went to the Wright Institute in California. And I said, yeah, how do you know that? He said, oh, well, I did my dissertation on self-disclosure, and I actually emailed him with a question once. And I said, oh, he gets so many emails, like already planning to apologize. He's like, no, he responded. And I said, wow. Oh. So
rare.
Yeah. And it wasn't even about getting into a pro. It was just like someone emailing you who you had no idea who they were, asking you a question about your research, and you responded right away.
Okay. So I'm glad I do that. But I suspect people who are far more famous than me, including some in our program, get, you know, enough emails that they can't respond. what was the question?
So, yeah. So I wanted to know, is it helpful to email potential advisors to introduce yourself before you apply?
Yeah. So I'm not an advisor, so I can't tell you how it would be received. I could just say that I think it is rare that it'll be transformative. It is not the case that I've ever heard an advisor say, oh, this application looks great. This candidate looks good, but why didn't they email me? That will never happen. I personally operate from like a risk averse place. So I think if you send this email and it's in old research, you're asking something about an old research project, like you got confused and this is something that they're not even doing anymore, or you sound not their style in the email, that could harm you because you could, you know, sound insincere or inauthentic. So personally, my thought was, if it's not going to open doors for me and it might hurt me or just be negligible, then I'd rather not do it. I didn't email any people. I did my networking by asking people who knew people to let them know that I was applying to their program, but I didn't email professors, but I think the sense, you know, I have never heard anyone say like, wow, I got this email from this candidate. I have my eyes out for their application. I don't know if it really transforms their opportunity. Do you ever have that, Dr. Farber, where like someone emails you a question and you like make sure to pay attention to like their application? You don't even remember.
Everyone gets too many of those. I want to introduce myself. What is helpful, if it's possible, is sometimes the emails that faculty will pay attention to is if I'll get an email from a colleague who'll say, this and this person is applying to your lab. I think you should pay it, yes, you know, give this person extra attention. That's far more powerful.
Yeah. I've heard that before too. And so really the key here is you're saying rely on professors you've already worked with, PIs that you've already worked with, and ask about faculty that they know at the institutions you, or faculty, if they know specific faculty that you, that are operating in areas that you're interested in, and if they could make like a warm introduction. Is that acceptable? Okay.
And just one other point for people who don't know people, like somehow the programs do a very good job. A lot of people, like most people that got accepted to most programs, didn't necessarily know the advisor before. So most just means more than 50%, right? So I'm just saying, like, I don't think there are many people whose application stands out without anyone emailing on their behalf and without them contacting the faculty in advance.
Okay. So now also finances, we don't have to spend too long on this because I feel like this is very individual, but if there are generally like, I mean, it's expensive to apply. It's expensive. It's expensive to study for the GRE, to take the GRE. It's expensive to send applications. It's expensive to schedule your interviews, travel to interviews. It's expensive. It can be thousands of dollars to apply. Do you know of any ways that like scholarships or fee waivers that people can look for, or how to look for those to make this a little bit easier financially?
So I think when it comes to the GRE, there are ways to make it more cost effective. So Magouche, which was my favorite study program, was like $65 for like 6 months with a guarantee that if you don't improve at a certain rate, then they'll give it to you the next 6 months for free. The other thing I would say, I reached out to Kaplan to take their course and it was like $2,500 or something. And I called them and was like, I am poor, please give me a discount. And they asked me to write like a one-page paper on why I'm a leader and evidence that I'm a leader. And then they gave me 70% off. And it wasn't based on what I wrote. It was like, it didn't matter. I had to submit something. But I think not being shy to ask for help or ask for discounts, it is expensive mainly to apply because of the cost of not working. And that's going to be a question you're going to have to figure out how to challenge. You're going to have to figure out how to navigate for many, many years. Other than a math tutor for the GRE or the GRE itself is not that expensive. I mean, $200, but I mean, these are not things that are going to make or break this process if you're able to do it. I would say don't skimp on the applications, actually. I get it, $75 or $100 for applications. Some programs are thinking of waiving those fees, but these are really pennies in the context of a 5, 6, 7 year investment. And so the cost of not making money for a long time starts maybe when you're trying to become competitive as an applicant, but continues for many years. And it's one of the costs of doing this. And we could have a whole nother conversation about, you know, access to equal opportunities when you don't have the same socioeconomic fortune, but that's a separate conversation.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, so $75 to $100 per school made me think of how many schools should people be applying to?
More than, not less than 10, and somewhere between 10 and 17, I would say, with like, maybe, I don't know. What do you think, Dr. Farber?
You know, I think it's about average. People are in the teens usually when they apply to programs. But I'd say this, you know, if you're not confident and not from some objective point of view, an extraordinary applicant, you know, you're going to get great recs, you have great experience, you have great GRE scores, then your best bet is not just to apply to, you know, the best PhD programs, but think really what you want. If you really want to be a therapist, maybe a good PsyD program is at least an alternative route, not instead of, but apply to a lot of students, I think, Daisy, right? Apply to both PhD and PsyD programs. They prefer getting into the PhD program, but they'll be happy if they've also been accepted into PsyD program. We have a student now who's not sure which one she's going to take.
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing to consider for PsyD is just how you're paying for it. Because I know people who have some financial help and aren't going to accrue a ton of loans versus if you accrue or the SID program themselves offer some funding. But if you're accruing $250,000 of loans and then those are growing in interest at right now, like 8%, it's a very, very high commitment. And so, I mean, I have friends who've done SID because they were left with money for tuition and it was the best decision for them. And there's like no regrets and it's wonderful. But I think with SID, the one thing to really think about is just how you're paying for it and how you're paying it back and not taking it lightly to commit to a massive, massive amount of loans in a field that doesn't have a huge financial return immediately. So it's something that I know some people with SID that have gone to SID programs without any financial assistance, the program was very expensive, did struggle after. So just something to think about.
Yeah. So getting to the major elements of the application, we have CV, we have the essay, we have the GRE, we have letters of recommendation, we have grades and transcript, and then we've already talked about clinical and research experience. So one question about the CV. Are there any keywords related to your research and clinical experiences that helps communicate your readiness? The answer might be no, but I just wanted to know.
I've never been aware of any.
Okay.
What do you mean by keywords? Keywords?
Yeah. Like for example, Daisy, you were helping me with my resume the other day or my CV, and we were talking about the word clinical and how that, I mean, I feel like this is obvious. Like it's important to include the word clinical.
Let me give some context. Maya had a clinical research opportunity, meaning she was working for a research lab, conducting clinical interviews and interacting with participants. And she had it listed under research experience. And I said, well, you should add it clinical research experience because that's clinical. It is important to obviously add words that will make you more competitive for a clinical position, which is what, you know, we were talking about there. I do think when it comes to a CV, again, getting feedback is really important. Don't be humble and don't lie. So whatever falls on the spectrum between being too humble and being dishonest, find some place in between. It's a CV. So you want to sound like you want to actually communicate that you learned something so you know how to talk about what you did. So for example, if you gave intakes or assessments and stuff, you don't need to say like, I asked questions to participants. That would sound interesting, right? You would maybe want to say conducted clinical interviews and then in parentheses, what they were, depending on what they were, right? So you want to sound like you know what you're talking about. And so I think with a CV too, it's really, really helpful. People specialize in this. And again, thinking about the longer term commitment in the context of not sacrificing minor things. So if it's going to cost you $50 or $150 to get feedback on your CV from someone who does this, or you know somebody who's a doctoral student, a friend of a friend, ask. I look at like more than 100 of these in the past year and a half, I would say. Just quick, someone will look at it quickly, give you some feedback. Don't be shy.
Yeah. Okay. Now moving on to the essay. This is a huge area that people have questions about. What makes for a competitive personal statement? What are things people should write about? How do you stand out on the personal statement?
Well, we talked about this a little bit. I think, you know, you want to, faculty reading this wants to get a flavor of the person, not just your accomplishments, but who's the person behind the accomplishments. I think that's important. Maybe provide a specific example of something you've done that you're proud of, or even that you failed at, but really make sure it's written well. You know, to say the obvious, don't throw typos in there. It should be grammatically perfect, the whole thing. Mm. This is important. Let's, as Daisy said, make sure that people who you think write extremely well have read it.
So Barry, before you mentioned that your statement should not be a regurgitation of your CV, what should the relationship between the CV and the statement be?
Well, it can include aspects of your accomplishment. My take is that it shouldn't just be a recitation of your accomplishments. There's got to be some details, some feelings. You're applying to a clinical psychology program. So what's the nature of your interpersonal connections to people? What's your sense of, you know, why this work is important to you? I want to know not what you've done, but why it's important to you, you know, why you've done it, how you've done it, what you've overcome, perhaps, is an obstacle to getting where you are. It sounds a little bit like a Miss America question, actually, but I think you get the point at this point.
Yeah. So let me ask you, what are things that when you see them are just complete kisses of death in the essay, besides typos?
Yeah, it's okay. Besides typos, too much personal information that makes me cringe, awkwardly phrased sentences. I'm like a stickler for grammar, but that's not true of everyone, by the way. It's just my own piece, but something, you know, that I'll say, you know, you're smart, but I'm not sure who this person is behind the smarts. You told me, I don't know who you are.
Yeah. Daisy, when you're helping students write their statements, what would you say are things you consistently see people getting wrong that you hope to kind of help them do less of?
Number one, sounding cocky or arrogant. Number two, just trying to sound smart, like having a lot of jargon, and like the professor reading this is not trying to decipher your like super sophisticated language. It doesn't give them a sense of who you are. Super boring, like similar to just writing out your CV, like I did this, then I did that. I think what does really, really make an intriguing personal statement is when people ask themselves, like, how do I thread all of these different fabrics together? And in that, and you don't have to include everything you've ever done, but what are like the significant experiences that you've had that have impacted, like, what are the experiences you've had in your life that have led you on this path, your fascination with human behavior, your interest in like comforting people who are distressed, whatever it is, and kind of what piqued this interest? And then what are the core experiences that you've engaged in that either furthered you down this path or turned you in a different direction? And why are you here today? Why is this program the right fit? Why is working with you a good fit? What are the things I'm interested in doing that working with you, I can A, be interested in what you're doing, and B, want to take that a step further by offering you my experiences, my skills, my opportunities, and kind of expand on your work and really providing, think of it like a story, a good story in three pages that kind of taps all of those points.
So would you say it is a kiss of death if you don't mention a particular faculty member that you want to work with and why that research is interesting to you?
To a mentor model program?
Yes, to a mentor model program.
Yes.
That's a kiss of death.
Yes. And don't mention multiple people. I'm happy to work with A, B, C, and D. That means that you're not interested in, that means you just want to be here.
Yeah.
Which is fine, or would have been fine 20 or 30 years ago, but it's not what this program is asking you to do.
Mm-hmm. And to add to that, I mean, I think in our program, if you didn't specify any advisor, your application might not be read because it literally gets sent to the advisor. You click advisor on the website when you're submitting your application, you click who it should go to. So if you click to go to an advisor and then you indicate no interest in that specific advisor, it's strange. You would say in your application, like, under the mentorship of Dr. Barry Farber at Teachers College within this community, like you do specify it. Even in programs, many LIU, FDU, I think Adelphi, a lot of programs aren't officially mentor model. You're still St. John's, you're still going to mention professors whose research interests you, and you'll often mention two, and you'll indicate why. So if your statement is about wanting to work with children or underserved individuals, you'll say so-and-so's research in X and so-and-so's research in Y are particularly interesting and would give me the opportunity to blah, blah, blah. You're still often going to mention. So talk to people in the programs to find out, but I haven't even seen a statement that has no mention of any professors. You don't want to indicate to a program that's not a mentor model that you think it's a mentor model. Don't make that mistake, but do mention professors that you would like to work with. In the non-mentor models, you're still working in a lab. You're just not picking one advisor to work under them directly. You're still gonna work with one or two professors.
Yeah. I just want to preface, I mean, if people don't know what mentor models is, I mean, you just said it, but mentor models is you get matched to a particular advisor that you work with throughout graduate school. I don't know how many opportunities there are to change your mind if the relationship isn't working down the line. We won't talk about that too much because that's not about applying, but yeah, so that's a mentor model, but not all programs are like that. Some programs you get to work with, some programs you can choose later, like you can get there, work, do a rotation, and then you choose your advisor. What am I missing? That's it. Okay. Last thing about the statement, I want to go back to something that Barry said before about TMI. So a lot of students get into this field because they either have personal experience with mental illness, or they have witnessed something, or they have family members or friends or whatever, and they're interested in it because it's been in their immediate environment. That seems important to mention in the statement. I anticipate a question that's going to come to people's minds when you say TMI is cringe. It's like, well, this is really the reason why I want to get into this. How much of it is TMI? Like, how much of it can I talk about? If it's really relevant to me, shouldn't I be able to just talk about why it's important and what that experience was to me and why I want to do this? So how do you gauge whether it's cringe or not?
I don't think I have a good answer to the question. Justice Potter was once quoted, someone wanted to give him a definition of pornography, and he said, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. of course you've been in therapy, or most people applying to clinical programs have been. And actually, most people who are applying to programs have had difficult childhoods. And, you know, they've either experienced that they've been helped by therapy, or they've been resilient for the most part to lousy life circumstances, and they think they're sensitive to others. And sure, that's a part of why they're applying. But that's, so you want to say you've been in therapy, or you want to even mention, you know, that you grew up with an alcoholic or abusive parent? Well, yeah, that makes sense to me. But to be a bit absurd, I don't want to know how many times you've been hit.
Yeah.
So, you know, to be a little absurd too, assumingly everyone who's applying have been out on dates, and you kind of, you're interpersonally skilled. You know, when you're trying to let someone know who you are on your first date, you know enough to get them engaged in the conversation, but they're just, you don't want to go too far with certain things. It's inappropriate.
Yeah. So, Daisy.
Yeah. So, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, if you wanted just an example, it's like, having had my own experience with mental health struggles and having benefited directly from therapy, blah, 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 I realized that I'm interested, versus like, I've been diagnosed with whatever, whatever disorder. And as a result, I was hospitalized. And again, this is not shaming. This is this what you want to put on your personal statement? That's actually misleading when it's only called a personal statement. It's a professional statement too. And so I think the real, real misconception to clarify here is what makes somebody a competitive candidate for a clinical psychology doctoral program is often certain skills. In every industry, in every discipline, there are different skills that make you competitive. Here, a fascination with human behavior, curiosity about human behavior, genuine empathy and ability to relate to people. All of these, excellent writer, good enough at math, good at research, a critical thinker, analytical, conscientious, whatever you want to say, these are the things that make someone a competitive candidate and a competitive PhD candidate and a competitive applicant. When you move the spotlight into extensively discussing your own history of trauma or mental illness or your family's, or focusing a ton on your own therapist helping you, you're also taking away the opportunity to indicate that you have all of these skills, because that's what programs are also looking at, a personal statement. How do you write? How do you think? How do you cohesively understand your own narrative? How do you prove to me or show me that you're really interested in human behavior? So if you're saying I have these own struggles, so it increased my empathy for it, or it made me realize the power of human connection and relationship and being heard or listened to and understood because it transformed my own life, that's okay because you're indicating that you have these skills. But to talk about extensively your own struggles, it doesn't mean you're going to be a great therapist because you've also gone through horrible things. It's like saying, I want to work in this industry that's going to make me a lot of money because I'm extremely, extremely, extremely poor, right? Like that might motivate you to work very hard, to learn a certain skill, to be skilled in a certain way. But it's a misconception about psychology programs in general. I think that there are very specific skills that they're looking for in a candidate. And yeah, I don't know if that helps.
No, it absolutely does. This is so helpful. And I think people are still going to have questions about how much of their personal experience they should mention. This podcast is not going to answer all your questions about that. Again, rely on people who understand this process and who know you to give you advice about what should be included and what shouldn't.
Okay. And I just have to clarify, this is in no way
not shaming,
stigmatizing anyone who has gone through trauma or experienced mental illness. It's saying, will it make you more competitive talking about that in a personal statement? Well, really think of it as a personal professional statement. If anything, a little bit leaning more toward the professional statement. So that's all. Is this the right place for it?
That's all. So helpful. Yeah. Let's move on to the GRE. How important are GRE scores? Is it more important than just making a cutoff? Will it ever be a decision maker?
For some faculty, it will. For faculty, probably privileging the clinical part of the clinical research aspects, they're going to look at the verbal GRE scores or privileging even writing. But more and more faculty members in clinical programs are very, very focused on research, you know, and they'll want very high quant scores.
And just add to that, that there is a minimum. I can't talk about how competitive will make you the higher you get, but that if you're extremely low and you don't have a very specific story, like you know an advisor really well because you worked with them for years, but you just have a certain reason why you can't do well in one of the sections and they know you and they know you're really smart and you have all the skills, maybe that's an exception. But generally, the way I describe it is the GRE is the door. And in the room, you have all of your competitive attributes as a candidate. Many faculty and programs will not open the door to see what is in that room if you're below a certain number, because they get a sheer number of too high of a number of applications to possibly go through so many. And so if somebody is extremely low on the GRE, it's often just a cutoff of like, we can't review all of these. And the comforting thing I'll say about this is that barring exceptions of like major testing anxiety or specific issues with the GRE is a skill on how to take the GRE. And it is rare, although not impossible, it is rare that somebody prioritize it and go through hours and hours and hours of studying truly for an extended period of time and won't be able to increase a few points. And it's not fun and it's kind of soul sucking a lot of times, but if it's really important to someone to do this and they're willing to put in the time, most of the time you could get that minimum score. And I know lots of people who moved up 10, 20 points once they realized how important it was. And it took them 3 months and it ruined their summer, but then they did it.
Yeah. So a lot of people are saying right now that the GRE is less important and a lot of schools are dropping it, especially after COVID. I don't know how this works actually. If programs are not considering the GRE this cycle, when will they let students know?
APA makes you update your website. They're pretty strict about it. I suspect, again, if it's not up in September, well, that may not be helpful. Look, not up and it's not clear, the thing to do is to email the program secretary.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I ask is because if the programs I'm applying to aren't even going to consider it or don't or you know, don't see it as important, then I'm not going to spend money and time taking it, right. You know?
Right.
Daisy, sorry, did you want to add something?
Just quickly that like nothing would, I mean, something maybe, but very few things would make me happier than this requirement being waived, because it does exclude a lot of people who would be very strong candidates. And I will just say that if programs waive it entirely, like they do not want it, blessed, everything is great. If they allow you to submit it and they just don't require it, look at yourself as an applicant and ask yourself if you have a good reason why you would not want to submit the GRE, other than you just don't want to study for it. You went to a great undergrad, you had access to a lot of resources, you clearly, that is clear in your application, you just didn't want to take the GRE, and the programs, especially because this is a recent thing, they don't require it, but they don't waive the requirement entirely. I don't think you're just going to get away. My gut, and I could be totally wrong, I would love to be wrong, is you're not just going to get away scot-free. I think this is a way to, a very fair and good way to kind of equal the playing field for people who haven't had similar opportunities and therefore can't do well in the GRE or are not able to do well in the GRE, and giving them a chance to be considered. But it's not going to just be a free-for-all, I think, for a while, is my guess. Unless, again, it becomes like completely don't submit it.
Yeah. So you're saying if it's optional, then lean towards submitting it, unless there's some outstanding crazy reason that.
Not even outstanding crazy. Sorry, Dr. Barber, go ahead.
No, it doesn't have, you know, I'm just going to agree with you. It doesn't have to be outstanding crazy. It could be English as your second language. That's good enough to invalidate your GRE score.
Okay. So could you, I mean, are there places to indicate why you wouldn't submit it? If it is, if there is an option to submit it, is there ways to say, you know, the reason is because X, Y, Z?
Yeah, you can always add that on your personal statement.
And then do you need
Both applications will have like a box for like, explain, here's your opportunity to explain away any weaknesses or something.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. And then what about the psych GRE?
Less important in my experience than the verbal and the quant. I mean, mostly because every school doesn't require it. Some schools do though, so you have to do it.
If you didn't study psych in undergrad and you're like lacking in your core courses of psych, it could be more helpful than if you have like a master's and an undergraduate degree in psych. Maybe also the psych GRE won't seem that necessary.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else you would add about the GRE before we move on? No? Okay. Letters of recommendation. What should an applicant do if they can't identify anyone who knows them well enough to write a strong letter of recommendation?
Apply the following year.
And then what should they do in the interim in that year?
Get to know a faculty member or two quite well.
How do you do that?
Work with a faculty member on his or her research.
Uh-huh.
You know that it's important too. You put in extra hours. You find out how you could be helpful to this faculty member. Daisy has considerable skills in many ways. I got to know her because when she was a master's degree student, she let me know that she really wanted to be helpful to some of the projects I was working on.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard from professors, you know, don't ask me for a recommendation if I only know you from one class. Like, I'm not going to write you a good enough. Are there exceptions to that? Do you agree with that?
Well, no, because it could be one small class in which you've been outstanding, in which case I'm glad to write you a strong recommendation.
Okay.
Right.
Also, the letter of rec piece, I think someone who could speak to your skills, who's known you for a while, it doesn't only, you do want to have a researcher speaking to your research skills, ideally, and a clinician speaking to your clinical skills. But the third letter, especially, it could be from someone that you worked with in a different field, especially if they could speak to relevant skills. We've had philosophy majors, lawyers, journalists, recruiter. People are change disciplines all the time, and maybe not all the time, but they have excellent letters of recommendation from a boss or a partner. And it has also gone a long way. So it's not that everyone has to be within this field. And some people think like a bigger name, but a weaker letter is better. And I haven't. Yeah. Okay. So not it's not
close.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are important like criteria for your, when you're considering to yourself, who do I ask for a letter? What are some boxes you should check about this person in terms of your relationship with them? Daisy or Barry, either one of you.
Well, you're going to need two real professional letters. I agree with Daisy. A third letter can be from someone from, you know, with whom you work with in a different sphere and talks about your terrific interpersonal skills or your organizational skills or your conscientiousness, all of that. But you should have two good letters from people, you know, talking one or the other, or both, hopefully, you know, alluding both, at least one of the other should allude both to clinical and research skills. If both letters are on clinical skills, then someone's going to read this and say, well, a person may be a good clinician, but what do I know about his or her involvement in research? And conversely, if both of them are about how great you are in stats and, you know, and recruiting subjects, that's nice, but you're going to probably, no matter what you say in your application, you're probably going to be working with clients soon after graduation. Maybe we should talk about that, the extent to which you're allowed to lie in your application about how interested you are in doing research.
Yeah. Can we talk about that actually? Can we talk about that? Because that, I feel like I've almost asked that question a few times. Depending on what kinds of programs you're applying to, I feel like there is kind of in a lot of PhD programs, like they're training academic. They want you to go into academia. They want you to become a faculty at the end of it. Right?
Well, that's a yes, but I mean, that's true. I mean, it accrues more prestige to a program to the extent that at least some graduates become faculty members themselves. But frankly, APA is a little bit hypocritical around that. If everyone in a PhD program wanted to become academics, about 10% of them would get jobs. So yeah. There just aren't enough jobs for everyone who says they want to be a researcher. So, you know, there's a discrepancy between what APA says they're training and the available opportunities, you know, to be gainfully employed after graduation. The truth is that most people, even those who say I'm very, very interested in research, come out and mostly do clinical work. So I think most faculty members are aware of that discrepancy, you know, but that said, there's still a continuum between those who, look, everyone's got to say they're interested in research, but then you have to, you know, sort of, what's the continuum? Those who are at least interested enough to be conscientious and get involved and be open to the fact that some research might be more interesting than they think. And those for whom they're just going to, you know, grit their teeth and reluctantly do what the faculty member wants. And that's going to be a bad match and make graduate school miserable. You know, so there's a sweet spot, you know, where you may not love it, but you like it enough and you get interested enough and you get off on getting your name published, which is a kick for most people. So I think if you're really not interested in doing research at all, and have to grit your teeth to think about it, don't lie. Apply to a PsyD program or a master's degree program. There's got to be some minimal degree to which you think you can get involved and, you know, really get into it.
Mm.
There's a comedian you quote when it comes to the lie, Dr. Farber.
What do I say, Daisy? I don't remember.
About you have to be really good at fake.
It's a George Burns line. This is snarky. George Burns, who was an old comedian in the 1950s and had his, you know, TV show with his wife, Gracie Allen, used to say, the most important thing in life is to be sincere. And if you can fake that, you've got it made.
There's some level of embellishing, or there's some level of saying what people want to hear, but like Dr. Farber saying, if you detest research, saying that
don't
you
do
really
a PhD.
Do it, then you're going to, yeah, exactly.
Just don't do a PhD.
But you could say you like it a little bit more than you actually do, and that's okay.
Yeah. Okay. One last question about the letters of rec. Where was it?
Well, while you find it, I'll just tell your audience, don't underestimate the GRE as things stand now. Don't underestimate the power of letter of recommendations.
Yeah. I don't remember what it was. Must have not been that important. If it comes back to me, I'll ask it. The last element that we haven't talked about yet is GPA and grades and transcripts and to what extent that's important. What are your comments on that? How important is your GPA?
Let me be glib. I don't think it's very important at all unless you've done miserably.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Because of grade inflation. The truth is that 80%, I'm making this up, almost everyone who applies is at least a 3.6. And there's lots of 3.9s. And everyone says, I can't believe I haven't gotten interviewed. I got a 3.9. Well, 500 other people interviewed are applying with a 3.9. So, you know, there are some universities, colleges in the United States for whom you have to work real hard to get lower than an A minus.
What if your grades are bad? Or what if you you didn't do as well, let's say freshman, sophomore year, or even junior year, and that really brought down your GPA. What if your GPA is like a 3.3 or a 3.0 What then?
Well, the truth is you're going to be a far less competitive applicant. I think it only makes a difference on the low end. I think anything over, and again, almost everyone is applying with a 3.6 or over. If you're applying, you know, with a 3.3, you have less of a chance of getting in unless you can really explain this.
This is hard to hear, I think, for some people because GPAs are things that, especially in undergrad, more than graduate school, people work really hard to get a high GPA. But the thing is, like Dr. Barber saying, a low one could weed you out. A high one will put you in a pool of many, many other applicants. And that's also a lot of the people applying. It's not just like everyone's applying to doctoral programs. People that have good GPAs are often part of this 500-600 application pool. So you're not standing out with a high GPA, but you're standing out with a low GPA.
Exactly. Mm. Perfectly said.
So, and I think this goes back to reasons to maybe get a master's, right? Like if you don't do well in undergrad and you really want to do this and you've become more serious about school, maybe that's an opportunity for you to get a master's and show that you are able to score highly if you put your mind to it. Yeah.
And that's the answer to this question in every way. If you look at all those buckets I talked about before, GRE, GPA, and GRE is the only thing a master's won't help with, but any of the things that clinical experience, research experience, letters of recommendation, et cetera, if you're lacking sorely in any of those areas, a master's could likely help.
Okay. No, this is actually so helpful. Especially, that master's discussion, I've never been able to give students answers around that, but I feel like you really laid it out in a way that is very helpful, with sort of reflection prompts that people can really think about. So, one thing we didn't really talk about is fit. And did we talk about fit? Now I'm like, it's all a blur. I don't think we did very much.
How to pick your, like,
yeah, like how to assess fit, like how to, let's say once, yeah. How to assess fit? How to assess if you're a good fit for a program?
I guess one metric would be is theoretical orientation. I'm not sure how important it is, but you know, if you've been in psychodynamic therapy and you're impressed with thinking about, you know, dynamics and you've read, you know, the great psychodynamic thinkers, then it might not be a great fit if you're going to a very strictly CBT program. I think that's, you know, one piece of, you know, one way of thinking about fit. What are other ways, Daisy?
Go ahead.
I have a question. So fit obviously also means between not just the theoretical orientation and the structure of the program, but also how well you fit in the lab of the faculty member that you're going to work in. And so I wonder, a big question that comes up for me in a lot of interviews that I do is like, how do you assess if your faculty member is, if your personalities get along, or if, you know, if you'll be able to have a fruitful mentorship relationship before you even enter the program?
I think that's an easier question to answer. I think much of your homework is in talking about other graduate students already in the lab. It doesn't matter what's on the website. It doesn't matter what this person has written. It doesn't matter that you think the person's brilliant, that, you know, whatever. Talk to other students who've worked with this person. There's no substitute for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Reach out. So it's acceptable to reach out. Daisy, do people reach out to you as a graduate student in Dr. Farber's lab asking you about your experiences in it?
Once they're invited for an interview. Actually, one or two people have reached out to me before, and I'm very open to making time for a lot of people at a lot of stages. And that's not one that I personally prioritize. Like, I want to know what it's like to be in your lab. I submitted an application and I'm like, and if we interview you, I'll be happy to talk to you about it. So I think generally people could wait. If they're invited for an interview, it's completely acceptable to talk to people in the lab, to talk to graduates of the lab. And I think again, when it comes to fit, a lot of it is just introspecting on what is important to you. And sometimes that is a very easy question to answer. Like, two people in my cohort study spirituality and psychology, which is like a very niche area that maybe if that's what they're interested in, they could choose by which mentors in the world, let's say, or in America, study that, right? There are some topics that are a lot more broad, like trauma or psychotherapy research. And all programs or many programs will have faculty studying that. And then your question is a little bit harder. And then you can, again, think about other things like what program overall is a good fit and then which faculty within that.
So one last question about that is, let's say you have a certain research interest and it's pretty specific, but you don't necessarily fit into any of the projects that the faculty has going on at the moment. Should you be prepared to kind of just throw that out the window for the time being in graduate school, or how does that work? How do you fit in your maybe specific interests with the direction of the lab of the faculty advisor?
Tremendous variability in how open individual faculty members are to modifications in what they're studying. The in-between place is, let's talk about how what you're interested in might converge on what I'm interested in. But there are some faculty members, you know, who will say, I understand you're interested in this, but this is what this lab is doing, and this is what you need to be doing.
Mm-hmm. There's so much that we did not cover, which is crazy because this has been going on forever, but there's still a lot of ground that we didn't cover. So I recommend people continue to read about this, continue to reach out to people you trust, and send questions to PsychMike, and we can cover things in future interviews and in blog posts and newsletters and things like that. But I wanted to ask you guys if you had anything else to add before we wrap up. Daisy, I think you had something to say.
I have one thing to say to your listeners, which is from my experience, a lot of people who are not in the field of psychology or not aware of how this kind of whole process works, the idea of spending a year or two or even three after grad school or after a bachelor's program is very foreign, especially if you're not making money. And so one of the things I realized in my own life is like, I did a lot of that. And then I started a program, and both stages had a lot of barriers to navigate and a lot of challenges to navigate. But while I'm in a program, I don't feel alone and I don't feel alienated from other people's perspective because I'm surrounded by people who have gone through similar processes, who have faced similar challenges, and I have a lot of direction and a lot of support from my program. But I do remember the stage between undergrad and a master's, or between a master's and PhD, where like I felt very alone and uncertain. Like, is this normal? Like, to push off applying for one more year because I don't have a good letter of rec, or to push off applying for one more year because my GRE scores are not competitive. Mm-hmm. Like, other people would be like, what are you, you know, this doesn't make sense. Another year of not working and another year. And I just want to normalize that this stage is lonely and a little bit isolating, and especially with a lot of other people not understanding what it kind of takes. And so reach out to students. All 95% of the students I know have gone through a lot of stress and struggle in the process of developing their profile into being a competitive candidate and getting the experiences required. And so if it does feel lonely or isolating, reach out to people, cold email people. Mm-hmm. And you're not alone. This is kind of what it takes. And I think mm-hmm. it's quite worth it. That's mm-hmm. mine.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Daisy. Thank you so much. You give a lot of hope. Like, this is such a competitive process. It's so difficult, but you have made me feel so much better about where I'm at. And I know you've made a lot of my audience members feel that way too. You were a panelist on our grad school panel back in November. You did the same. I heard that same feedback. So you are just incredible. Thank you for being here and sharing that. Dr. Farber, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your insights. It has been invaluable. Thank you so much.
Good luck to all your listeners.
If you're left with more questions after this two-part series on becoming a competitive applicant to doctoral programs, then please let me know what they are so that we can make sure to get them answered in the future. You can reach out through email at psychmikepodcast@gmail.com or through Instagram at the handle psych_mike. We'll see if we can get those questions answered in a future podcast episode, a blog post, an Instagram post, or the newsletter. Speaking of which, you should absolutely go sign up for the newsletter on psychmike.com if you want opportunities to submit questions for future episodes like this, or if you'd like written resources and tips about your career path that will help you get from where you are now to where you want to go with your psych background. Lastly, if PsychMike has ever helped you learn about a career path, has helped you answer a difficult question, has piqued your curiosity, or has helped you in any other way, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It is currently the single most important thing that you can do to support the podcast, aside from sharing it with your friends. PsychMike will be taking a short break next week, so there will not be an episode next Thursday, but you can expect to find us again in 2 weeks. Thank you again for supporting PsychMike with your questions and your enthusiasm, and I seriously can't wait to catch you next time.